Good morning, everyone, and welcome to Room 42. I'm Liz Fraley from Single Sourcing Solutions. I'm your moderator. This is Janice Summers, our interviewer, and welcome to Krista Kennedy and Noah Wilson, today's guests in Room 42. Krista is an associate professor of writing and rhetoric at Syracuse University. She is PI, I don't know if I know what that means, PI of the Disability Data and Surveillance Project, principal investigator, I'm guessing, affiliated with Syracuse University's Autonomous Systems Policy Institute. And for this 2020-2021 year, she's an NEH visiting professor of writing and rhetoric at Colgate University. She is fascinated by the ways humans work closely with technology and the rhetorical implications of policies and laws that shape the work. Her experience as a deaf academic informs her current project, which examines the intersection of deafness, artificial intelligence, passing, and ethics of medical data collection. Noah is a PhD candidate at Syracuse University's Composition and Cultural Rhetoric Program, and he's a visiting instructor of writing and rhetoric at Colgate University, where he teaches first-year writing, rhetorical history, and theory and surveillance rhetorics. I love this next part. He's curious about the way technologies shape our rhetorical actions, and his dissertation addresses recent trends in social media content recommendation algorithms that have led to increasing political polarization in the US and the proliferation of radical conspiracy theories like QAnon and Pizzagate. Today, Krista and Noah are here to help us start answering the question, how do medical wearables and privacy concerns intersect with patient materials and communication? Welcome.
We are so happy to be here.
Yeah, this will be a lot of fun.
Yes, we're very happy to talk with both of you. So first, let's talk about how you guys got together. If you could share with people how that is the origin story.
Yeah. So for this project specifically, or just how I met Krista, Joshua specifically. So I had taken a grad seminar class with Krista, writing and technology, and I was started to drift into looking at like surveillance, and I was really interested in this. I didn't know there's something called surveillance studies at the time, and so in working on that project, you know, getting feedback on that, she proposed that maybe we should work together on this because there's something that she was interested in. I don't know where to fill in all the gaps in between, but like that work kept growing. We've written a couple of things together. I ended up having my exam article about some of that work, but there was still like this nagging thing about surveillance and medical wearables and AI that I hadn't really scratched. And like my dissertation was going in a slightly different direction, but we had done a chapter in a collection called Digital Ethics, and it's about like online aggression. And that's where like some of this thinking started happening. And then we started extending it more towards the article that we have now. I don't know if I've missed anything, Krista, or if that's a good broad overview of how we started with this project, at least. But I've worked with Krista for a while, and she's a great mentor. And we talk a lot. We do a lot of projects, and I'm glad she's at Colgate with me right now. It's been nice.
Yeah, that is pretty much what happened. About somewhere around 2016, I started writing about hearing aids, actually, even though I've been deaf since I was two. I was not remotely interested in writing about disability or connections between disability and technology. So my earlier research was on digital and print textual technologies and what it meant to author in across contexts. But then I began to write about this and got interested in human-machine collaboration and the way that working very, very closely with an assistive technology results in an interesting kind of relationship where the machine shapes human performance, but also human performance change technological performance. So I was thinking about that, teaching the seminar that Noah mentioned, and we just started talking. It was one of those wonderful conversations that sprang up. He was doing very separate work on surveillance, but I thought, hey, here's this really interesting student, and I've got a database I need to build. Would you come help me do that? And so we did that one summer, and we just kept talking, and we kept doing a lot of thinking both together and separately about this ever since, and it's been really productive. So the work we do is part of the larger Disability Data and Surveillance Project, and we have another partner, Charlotte Scheider, who is an assistant professor of law at Loyola University Chicago School of Law. Mm-hmm. And so she's the legal mind on this team, and she and I have known each other since grad school, and for a long time we're just friends. We went to the farmer's market every week when we were in graduate school together, and then went on to separate careers, me as a professor and her in various corporate contexts. And then at some point I was babbling on Facebook about working on this with Noah, and she said, oh, hey, what about some interesting aspect of it? And we've been all working together ever since.
So with medical devices, they're gathering all of this information, but they're not telling you that they're gathering this information?
It really depends on the type of device. We're interested in compulsory medical wearables. So the medical wearables that you don't necessarily opt in to wearing. For me, that's a smart hearing aid, but we're also thinking about things like, you know, all of a sudden the words are not coming to me. Insulin pumps and
right.
and things like that. And those typically don't provide a whole lot of data directly to the wearer. Although, you know, it depends. Insulin pump people do need, you know, some access to their data so they can calibrate things. But that's very different from a Fitbit that you opt into wearing, that you're not going to die if you take it off. And the entire purpose is to feed you data on your performance, on your body's performance, so that you can use that in order to improve in all the ways that you would like to improve. So in the case of the smart hearing aids that we look at, almost no data actually is provided to the wearer. That goes to the audiologist, and it also goes back to the manufacturer in the form of big data for R&D purposes.
So they're not giving you that, they're not communicating this, they're not explaining all of this to the end consumer. Like in Fitbit, you can log in, like probably a bad comparison, but I happen to have a Fitbit on. So, but I, you know, I don't even think about the data that it's collecting on me, and I was reading in your article, and you said Fitbit, and I'm like, oh, hey, I wear one of those. So it brings up a really interesting, because what is all of the data that they're collecting? And am I seeing all of the data? And can I opt out of, like, this is an option, right, to wear this. It doesn't, like, you bring up a really good point. My life does not depend on the Fitbit, right?
Right.
So I could choose not to wear it, but you can't choose not to have your insulin pump.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you really can't make that decision. You can make a decision to wear a different insulin pump. But there are two sides to this, two aspects of it. One is the difference between American and European privacy doctrine.
Uh-huh.
So in the U.S., you know, we get our device, whether it's your Fitbit, your hearing aid, your insulin pump, and it says, you know, do you agree to this? And you click yes. And if you click no, then basically you're saying, I'm not going to use this device. And
right.
So there's not really a meaningful way for you to opt out of data collection. The GDPR in Europe is a little more fine-grained, in which it does mandate that you have some sort of access to your own data, that you have a meaningful way to opt out, you know, and that there's the room for at least some sort of exchange of information between the wearer and the corporation that's actually making the device. So part of that is just, you know, our overall expectations when it comes to what you might call biocapitalism and, you know, the sort of data that you continuously scrape to this sort of device. But maybe it's also useful for me to say a little bit about the types of data.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That one gets from, I mean, our case study focuses on this Darkey Halo hearing aid, which was the first smart hearing aid that was really widely adopted internationally.
Right.
And I want to say 2013. I got mine in 2014, and it was part of what got me so interested in this topic. And I also want to say that we're not picking on Starkey by using this as a case study. They're not an evil company. They are a large international company that makes fantastic products in
mm-hmm.
a heavily regulated industry, and they're following the guidelines.
Mm-hmm.
We use them as a case study precisely because they are absolutely unremarkable when it comes to the sort of data collection that they're doing and the way they do or don't disclose this to the wearers. That hearing aid has multiple algorithms within it, and the current generation, which is the Liveo, has even more, and it's actually marketed as an AI hearing aid. But, I mean, for instance, in mine, there are algorithms that work with my hearing range. I don't have a lot of high range in mine, so it's grabbing all those higher sounds, which include women's voices, and compressing them down into my range. So mm-hmm. when you're talking, I'm probably not hearing your actual voice. It's also running an algorithm that distinguishes between syllables and separates out your speech a little bit, that filters out all the ambient sound around me and especially behind my head. So there's a lot of directional mic switching that happens.
Right.
There's feedback that's being throttled, which is really useful if you're wearing a hat in the winter in upstate New York. So there's a lot that's happening there. And the real innovation about the Halo was also that you could set up what were called soundscape memories that are geotagged. Because that particular hearing aid, all smart hearing aids, tend to work with a smartphone. And you no longer have all the little switches and buttons that you would use to control volume. You do that from the app on your phone. Which means you have telemetry, which means you can do things like set up, in my case, a memory for the grocery store down the street that has a lot of tile floors that makes carts rattle really, really loudly. I can filter that out and it knows when I'm in the store and it just automatically toggles to that setting. So that also means that your hearing aid in some ways, I'm talking about the ecology of the hearing aid here. It knows where you are and it's tracking that data. So all of your sound levels are being tracked, where you are is being tracked. Your rate of speed is being tracked because one of the handy things about this hearing aid is if you're going more than 5 miles an hour, it assumes you're in a car and it starts to throttle out road noise and car noise and things like that. So these are things that are really, really useful. I mean, I wear one of these. I like it. I don't want to go back to wearing another hearing aid, but there is a trade-off.
Right. All of those things make your life better.
Yeah.
Right.
You make my life a lot better.
Some great features that really can help make things a lot more comfortable for you. So they're beneficial for sure.
You know, and I willingly opt into wearing one of these. Before my feet hit the floor in the morning, my hearing aid is in and it's the last thing I take off at night. So depending on how long my day is, that's, you know, 14 or 18 hours of data. And I'll keep doing that. I like these hearing aids. I like the way they let me run my life. I'm glad they exist. At the same time, I do think that it's possible to be more transparent about the data that's collected, how it's transferred, how it's stored, if it's resold, what purposes it's put to, and to let people know what's being collected as they wear these devices that are really good.
Right. And I think those were the advices that you had in the conclusion. Like there were several things that you found from studying all of this that you felt if they acted on these things, that would make things better for people and more transparent. I think transparency is kind of key. Like I can see. I hate to keep using the Fitbit. That's the only device I have. but one of the things I can see, like my scale is actually a Fitbit scale. So it all communicates and Bluetooth together and I can see on my smartphone, but I can track all that and I know what data they're collecting. I don't know if there's additional data, right?
Yeah.
So, but knowing all this and transparency, I think is one of the key things in communicating that and writing clear communications.
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things that Starkey and Fitbit, I'm assuming, I don't have a Fitbit, but I have an Apple Watch, do really well is their legal disclosures that exist are in great plain language. They're short, they're accessible. You know, these are not the long legal documents that people just, you know, get yes on. And I think it's possible to take, there are a lot of challenges that we can talk about in just a second, but one would hope it would be possible to get to the point to maintain that great plain language practice. And say, you know, here are the types of data we're collecting. Here's how we store it. Here's how we transfer it. We're going to resell that because that's a commodity for us, you know, and make those sorts of disclosures. You know, and also just let people know what sorts of algorithms are in play. What do they do? We reverse engineered the Halo actually through observable functionality. And because Charlotte, for a number of years, was a member of the Target app team, you know, which also collects data in a number of ways. And so she was familiar with a lot of functionality of an app and data collection. And the nice thing is that she does have acquaintances with Starkey. So after we were done, she was able to kind of informally go, is this right? And they went, Pretty much, yeah. So simply saying, you know, they're really interesting features. I'm fascinated by things like syllable distinction and the sort of filtering that happens. And I think it's possible to say this is what we're doing without inching over into trade secret areas and the sorts of things that really do need to probably be kept quiet for proprietary reasons.
I was just kind of thinking with all this too, it's about a relationship between a technology user, a company, and in this case, an audiologist. But I think having those disclosure, that transparency helps to strengthen that relationship. And that's one of the bigger arguments too, is that it's not that people are, if they know these things, they're suddenly going to opt out. If anything, they would feel more comfortable opting in that they know, but the fact that these things aren't even listed, that's kind of the rub. What I really liked about the European law was that they labeled like algorithmic processes as something that have to be disclosed. And so that was something I didn't know much about that law. I know it's changed a lot of things, even with like websites, like that whole provision, but this idea of automated processes and like you have to disclose that they're happening, like there's these algorithmic decisions. But then the ability to object, I think, is huge under limited circumstances. Some of that is just offering them an explanation for what's actually being automated decision-wise. And like with a hearing aid, I can see a lot of that's going to be like a trade secret kind of thing. But this idea of like you're able to change your consent, I think is one of the recommendations we make at the end, is that if something were to change on Starkey's end, you should have the option to be like, I don't want to be part of your data set anymore. I think a lot of times with data, it's like, you're under terms, you feel good about it, but then like that company gets bought out or their trajectory changes, and sometimes that's not communicated in a way. Laws are kind of now, they don't necessarily have to ask users for that all the time. Or they don't have to be transparent. Like I could see like a really, maybe like a lackluster one being like an email, like, by the way, our data was bought by whatever. Like it should be better than that, I think. I think that, yeah, some of the recommendations we make will help with that. But it's really about the relationship between people that technology kind of is mediating in this sense.
Right. And I think, you know, whether or not you can use my data to sell, for lack of a better phrase, versus you're going to be collecting data, I should be able to opt to say it's okay to share this information with others and what I would want shared with others. Because as a participant, because I am a participant, even with the Fitbit or a device, I'm a participant. Like you said, you could choose different hearing aids. I'm participating. It's okay. You're being clear with me about the information you're gathering. And I can choose to allow you to use that data to help you, or I can choose to say, no, please keep my data private. That I think would be more fair and equitable.
I think so. I mean, like, I like that my audiologist has access to my data because it helps us do a lot of really personal calibration.
Yes.
Particular hearing aid. I don't necessarily loathe the fact that Starkey uses it for R&D because I want me and other people to have better hearing aids.
Yes.
Would I like to know how it's stored? Would I like to know the extent to which it's anonymized? And you know, anonymizing data is its own thorny thing. You know, what extent can you truly, you know, anonymize data? There's a lot of varying theories out there about that. I would like to know when it's resold and to who. That's the sort of, I'm not against data collection wholesale, although I think there are some things I would like to not have collected just for general privacy problems, not because I'm up to anything particularly interesting. But, I would like to know what happens to my data.
Right.
And I think there's a certain level I wish that impacts patient or wearer dignity. And that's the next stage of what we're working on, is thinking in a more theoretical way about how the sort of disclosure, lack of transparency, general opacity surrounding information in each context, how that connects with maintaining patient dignity, you know, across multiple medical contexts where you're working very closely with a compulsory medical wearable.
Right. You said you had to reverse engineer some of it. How clear were they? And what did you find or not find?
Well, they're not very clear at all. They weren't for the Halo. We've not yet looked at the material for the Livio. And the Livio is being marketed completely differently because it's being marketed as an AI hearing aid, whereas automation and algorithms were not mentioned in any of the literature connected to the Halo. So it's a very different way of marketing a hearing aid, because you don't normally talk about the hearing aid. And when you sell a hearing aid, you say, here's how your life's going to be different. You're going to be more social. You can hear your grandkids. You won't have to retire early, you know, all these sorts of things. But really, there was nothing said about how it worked, either in patient literature, in the literature that would apply to my audiologist. She was nice enough to let me take a look at it. Or in the patent filing, because we were thinking, okay, what are all the possible ways that a patient who's really determined might find this information? Probably most people are not going to go pull the patent, but we did, partly because we have a lawyer on the team, and it's not disclosed there either in any meaningful way. So we spent a lot of time mapping, you know, figuring out from white papers. Starkey is great about publishing their white papers, piecing together what we could from, you know, that portion of the website. You know, thinking about how this has worked across other apps. No way, you did a lot of research to figure out exactly how things like cell towers and Wi-Fi and satellites come into this. And
yeah, even
those.
Yeah, there's even like a document just finding like the official government document for talking about GPS satellites and the official way they describe how they work, but then thinking about how triangulation works with different things. And a lot of times, you know, a GPS satellite might be in play, but I was surprised that I found out that like cell towers are kind of part of that triangulation too, but it's still not like, I think the accuracy is pretty good. I mean, we're able to navigate by it, but even that's not like 100%. Like I live right near a cell phone tower and that kind of messes with my triangulation sometimes in some interesting ways where like it thinks I'm closer to the cell phone tower than I actually am. Like it's weird. Like I'm in such a close proximity that it thinks I'm close to that. But that's neither here nor there, but finding out those little things there. And then sometimes like Wi-Fi access points might come into play. And so it depends on, and each I guess platform, so like Apple is a big part of it. Like their way of triangulating your space is something that's very, very heavily tied to it. And correct me if I'm wrong, Krista, but I think it only works with an Apple iPhone, right? It only works with like that app, or do they have it on Android now? Or?
They brought that to Android now, but for a long time, it only worked with an iPhone. When we were running the study, I mean, it was an iPhone only hearing aid. And that was one of the surprises for me, is the first article I read about this for Communication Design Quarterly, I was only thinking about, you know, the ecology that is the human, the hearing aid, and all the algorithms and nano coding and other things that happen there, and the phone. And then when we really started to think about data for this larger study, and then we started to dig in, I was really surprised at how much you have to expand out in the world to think about how the network for this hearing aid actually functions.
Yeah. And I think that was one of the things that kind of struck me when I was, you know, breezing through your article was, you know, when you look at the network, because for me, pictures speak volumes. And when you look at the network, pictures is like all these other pieces that are in it. Because I was just thinking in terms of, well, person to the company, but there's all of these other data points or places in that connection where that big data is being shuffled around.
Yeah.
And it all feeds through the one app. So like you have this whole big, like collect everything, and then it gets translated through software that figures out what to do with that data. And then is that the only thing transmitted? But then like you have your GPS coordinates this way. I don't think necessarily that Apple like has recorded the TrueLink data, but it's interesting. It still is mediated through an app, which is then also taking data from, you know, the phone's regular working.
Phones,
and it's really, I was really surprised at how much the phone is necessary for that. And I think of like other technologies, like I even think of like VR, how a lot of the advances in VR because of the things we could do with phones. And I think it's really interesting that smartphones has opened up a I guess lower cost of entry to do things like this. Like I think in that ubiquity of the smartphone is what makes something like this possible, where like, because it has all this technology built into it. But again, it's like, how do you map that out? Like how do they incorporate and talk about maybe the ways the phone is used? I mean, I would expect maybe some discussion of like the different components, which we didn't see, but like a different components and how it collects data and filters it through. But then it's also like, well, where is like a phone's operations in this? I'm like, I was surprised. That'd be a question I ask. It's like, how is the phone integrated and how do you consider like the data you're getting from that, and what hurdles do you have for that, Starkey? And I wouldn't think to ask that before we actually kind of mapped it out and saw that like there's a lot of different networks of tech that are kind of working together in this one middle point. I think the only thing that actually like interfaces with like the human is a very, very small part of it, where like you would think that would be the most important part. But it's like all these other systems that make that part work.
Yeah. And one of the questions we really, you know, still, I don't think we'll ever answer within the scope of this team is how much of that data does Apple also have, especially when it comes to your location, you know, and that end of the telemetry. I don't know. Right. It's their device. They have access to it.
Yeah. So like, do they count it as just like to Apple? Is it just you doing like a coordinates thing? So is that data, is it the same for them as if you're looking up, you know, direction somewhere? But it's like, you know, because the TrueLink app is the mediator of that. So yeah, I wonder, to Apple, is it just like you use your GPS every day for everywhere you go and you're just constantly tracking yourself? Like, is that just the way it sees it? Or, and again, we'll never really know like what happens to that data or anything. You know?
Yeah. When you come into the world of surveillance, there's, boy, you can go down a lot of rabbit holes with that one.
Mm-hmm. You can.
Yes. I was just thinking that too. And we're talking about this in the context of patient materials and communications. And some of this is almost out of scope for that. I mean, in some way, it feels like it's out of scope, right? It's the who should explain that part.
And how, right? How? Like, so Liz, you're right on like where I was going is like, to how are you supposed to communicate this to, there's various people, right? So there's me, there's like the me of the world was like, look, I want the benefit of the Fitbit. I don't care about all the other stuff. I really don't. I know that my right to privacy, I just, for me personally, right, I make that decision and I can personally abdicate any rights to my data and it's fine because I want this trade-off. Now there's other people that want to know exactly what's being collected, exactly how you're handling it and who's handling my data. Right? But how do you communicate this to such a broad audience, from the extreme people who are like, whatever, I'll sign away, I don't care, to the people who really do want to know all of the details? How do you address that and communicate that?
That is a great question. You know, and as we prepare for this, I really was thinking about the fact that it's all very well and good for a bunch of academics to go, here's what we think you should do in a perfect world about this. And then the actual rhetorical problems and the legal problems on the ground for both the corporation and for technical writers.
Yes.
I mean, I think there were two sets of problems here. One is persuading people to wear hearing aids, and one is the documenting this. And I mean, the first, hearing aids have a very low adoption rate. I'm sure a lot of you in the audience have had an older relative who you think would benefit from a hearing aid, who doesn't want to get one, or who has them, but they live in a dorm, they don't want to wear them. Because it's a long process to learn to wear hearing aids, right? Mm-hmm. And as I said a little while ago, you don't sell a hearing aid by going, wow, don't you want the shiniest new hearing aid like you do a car or an iPhone or something like that?
Mm-hmm.
Because honestly, people don't. No human really wants to put something mechanical in their ear. We don't like having things in our ears. Whenever, when you were kids and we like run around giving each other wet willies to irritate each other, we don't like to put things in our ears.
The thought of it.
Yeah, cringing a little bit.
And humans also don't like amplified sound a whole lot. We do, we like our music loud, right?
Right.
But
right.
Learning to hear process sound is a whole different thing. So there are a lot of barriers, plus the cost. I mean, these hearing aids sell about $5,000 a pair, basically, mm-hmm. and you need an iPhone on top of that, and whatever other peripherals you need. So there's also a significant financial barrier to actually mm-hmm. successfully adopting hearing aids. So you sell these, not by going, don't you want to buy shiny technology, but by going, don't you want to be more social? Don't you want to be able to connect to your family?
It's a quality of life.
Right. It's absolutely a quality of life pitch. And that's been the most effective thing. Quality of life and also the part of quality of life that is health. Don't you want to stave off Alzheimer's by making sure you keep your language center more active and therefore you're more social, you're constantly problem solving, you're keeping your brain really active. That's really the persuasive move that a lot of hearing aid brochures, advertisements, you know, whatnot make to actually sell hearing aids. So saying, don't you want a robot in your ear, is not the way that people you know, really become most receptive to this. So there's the whole problem of selling this. And then there's the problem of, we spend a lot of time making something that's really proprietary. I'm Starkey. I don't necessarily want my competitors stealing my algorithms. I'm not going to talk too much about how they work, right? And then there's the problem of documenting, you know, what's essentially a black box, right?
Mm-hmm.
That if it's really based on smart learning, humans may not have a really deep understanding of how it's working at this point. I don't know if that's true in the case of hearing aids or not, but it's not unrealistic to wonder about it. And then also, how do you protect, you know, the proprietary aspects of this, especially if you're relying on trade secrets? So as a technical writer, I'm very curious what your audience would have to say about this, either the folks that are here right now or folks that might hear, you know, this podcast later on. How do you actually deal with these issues on the ground in an ethical kind of way? It's a very different scenario than like when I was learning to teach technical communication, we had all these case studies for Ethics Day, right? And it was like, you work for a company that's making heinous chemicals and dumping them into the waterway. Do you say something about that? That was like your ethics scenario. And this is worlds away from that, right?
Yeah. So
how do you document a black box that's proprietary, that's not hurting people and really helping them in some ways, but also has other potential problems down the line? And what's your ethical obligation to that? You know, it's just a completely different set of problems to wrangle. And I don't know the answer to it.
It's a tough question. And half the time, I don't think that the software engineers know the answer to that question either. And, or even really what the full implications are going to be when they're thinking it up at the time. Right?
Future here, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's one thing that struck me about the EU law stuff too, is like they're trying to account for this downstream kind of stuff. And we talk a lot, even before we kind of dug into like the EU law stuff, I know when we were first talking about this article, we were thinking about like, here's the immediate benefit, but then there's like these trickle down things that happen. So like, if all the preferences for this device are made for a particular kind of user, but what about the other users who can't afford it yet, but might be buying technology down the line that is informed by this research and is made more accessible, but maybe they have less customization. And so there's like, you know, there's a lot of down the stream kind of things. And it's hard to think about that. Like, if they ask anyone to think 10, 50, you know, 100 years into the future is tough, let alone when you have something where like, it is like a literal black box. But how do you ethically talk about, you know, the downstream effects of something we're just kind of getting a grasp on? And it's difficult. Even as someone like trying to theorize it, it's really difficult to talk about those things, because it's like, this could happen, or will this happen? And, you know, a lot of things deal with statistics or probabilities, even like the way surveillance kind of works with surveillance capitalism. It's all about like, the probabilities that something will happen, or you have a chance to do that, and like nudging. And so we're just dealing with a lot of uncertainty with numbers to kind of give us some direction. But I feel like some of the downstream stuff we talked about in the article are stuff that maybe think about, maybe to start opening up channels for people to at least get information when they need it. So I think that audiologist dialogue could be really, really important for like the human users, and also just having someone to talk to if you our users, like, I want to know how my data is being used. Maybe you're the only user out of like 100 who does, but to have a channel to ask those questions, even if you get stuck with, you know, you have to dial 1 and then 6, but eventually get to talk to somebody, at least having that, I think, is important.
Yeah. Having a touch point to go to ask information. Yeah.
Yeah. Cause then at least there has to be an answer to give those people rather than like, well, there's no one to ask.
I know you two had a good question you wanted to pose to the technical writers who are listening and watching. And we've got, I've got a comment that's coming back in that I will forward back around. But I don't want to, we're getting close on time. We sort of zipped past us.
We want to make sure though that we get that question out to people.
Yeah, a question I had, you know, thinking as tech writers, like, what parameters are you given for the writing that you do, and like, how much can you push back or ask questions, or is it kind of like, here are the directives, you have to work within it, and like, how much do you get the dialogue, I guess, with the people setting the parameters for what you're going to write? Like, that's something I've always been curious about. Like, and then how do you do that? What does that look like when you do push back or ask questions? And like, if you have done that, like, what kind of responses have you gotten? Like, again, I don't know. I've never been put in that situation per se. So like, I'm curious about that relationship with the person that you're writing for, I guess, on behalf of the user.
And I think that question could extend for the technical and professional writer beyond those who are doing medical devices.
Yeah, definitely.
It could be anybody. And it could be that your company is doing some kind of surveillance type equipment or not. It doesn't matter. Because I think all technical and professional writers run into this dilemma, mm-hmm. and all people would have valid input to give to NOAA.
Yeah, definitely. Like,
so I think everybody should, you know, kind of, this is a call out, all you professional practitioners, academia is asking you to answer that question. And NOAA's contact information is along with this podcast, it's on the page. So hit him up, blow up his email.
Yeah, and this is something that I talk about with my students. Like, we talk more about like social media platforms and privacy policies. And so again, thinking about like where are the points you could push back and what does that look like? So I have them try to remediate privacy policies with some of the stuff we learned in my surveillance class in mind. It's like, how would you just tweak a policy to be a little more transparent? Maybe it's just listing, you know, that name of someone you could contact, or like maybe it's just having a little more specificity. It's still pretty broad, but at least it's more than just like third parties. Like, what would be more specific? And so I kind of have them try to think about that as like someone writing these policies themselves and what that would look like. And, you know, a lot of them say like, well, what if the company won't tell me like any of that stuff? Like, what do I do then? So then I allow them to do a little more speculation, because like they can't ask Facebook, like, what would be more precise terminology for your privacy policy? But they can kind of think about what some of the stuff we learned with that. So that's partly why I'm interested in that question, is a curiosity about how to navigate this.
Yeah. And they can answer that question without divulging the company name.
Yeah.
Like, you don't have to tattle on your employer. Or, you know, tattle on a past employer, just, you know, just a scenario, and you know, you can keep the company names confidential, because there is that with some people. I can imagine that there'd be a confidentiality thing that they'd be concerned with. So they can answer the question without divulging that, because you're more interested in the practices and procedures and what happens in the real world, or, you know, in the commercial world.
Yeah, it makes me think of, I was teaching professional and technical writing. I taught a section of that, and so we talked about instructions, and like some of my students, like, this is good information for me to have, just like better prepare my students who might go on and do this writing.
They're going to be hiring your students.
And it blows their mind when they talk about ethics, because they're expecting, like Krista said, like that case study of like, you know, someone's dumping chemicals, what do you do? But more so it's like, well, how do you make sure that you've given like enough information to users, and how do you talk about that? My one student told me that like having those conversations was beneficial for her later on, like on interviews, like, cause she was thinking about those questions. And so I want to do more of that in like the technical writing classroom to help my students think about those problems now. And then they can incorporate that into their work, or even, you know, when they're looking to get that work.
Right. Well, hopefully people will take the time to respond to you, because part of the goal of Room 42 is to bridge that gap between academia and practitioners too. Right. So what was there another question you wanted to shout out to the audience to get their help in?
Oh, that was me. Actually, I asked it earlier when I was asking about, you know, really the on-the-ground difficulties of documenting black box algorithms.
Right.
And figuring out what you can document when you're also dealing with a legal team who's very concerned about proprietary information and trade secrets. I mean, when we're saying, oh, this should be documented, how much can really be documented?
Yeah.
I think there are multiple factors here that limit that at a practical level.
Right. I'd
love to hear what people are actually dealing with when you try to document these sorts of things.
Yeah, where do you draw the line?
Yeah. And where is the corporation drawing the line for you because of legal factors?
Right.
Who drew that line for who, in part, yeah, right? Exactly. Like,
yep. To what ends? And yeah.
I think that one of the things that we didn't really talk about, but I want to like close with, is it's really neat how you all came together, and it came out of just conversations and talking with a colleague, that you opened up this whole new place to find insight and dig into new policy research and communications. It's just like, you can't That is so very important. And it is just so neat to see that that's what a trigger for you guys.
Thanks. I don't know about that, but I feel really lucky. And I've learned a ton. I mean, Noah and I are both rhetoricians, but we work in different ways and in slightly different parts of the field.
Yes.
And, you know, Charlotte's master's in rhetoric, but then, of course, she's the JD. And so I think it's fair to say that we all really learn from each other in this situation. And I mean, we each have our own solo work, but I really love doing this work with this team, and it's been really productive.
Yeah.
Think about like early on, we had like this whiteboard, and it was like all the projects we wanted to do with this thing. And it was like this 3-year plan or 4-year plan. And I think we did almost everything on it. I think there was like one article that I didn't quite get around to, but I think about that. And I remember a session where Charlotte actually came up and visited us in Syracuse, and we just like buried ourselves in a library, and we were using whiteboards, and like we had to take pictures of these things because we had so many intersecting lines. And when I look back at the pictures, like, they didn't completely make sense to me anymore, because like I don't know where my eye was going with it, but it was just really cool to see like that's like the raw stuff, and like, you know, the conversation in like this graphical form. But those are like the fun moments, like when you get to like sit and just try to hash out an idea, and it takes a while and it's messy, and then you eventually have something that makes sense to other people.
Yeah.
We have a lot of energy. We keep finding out, you know, when Rhetoric of Health and Medicine asked us to do an interview, a written interview about the interdisciplinary nature of this. And we thought, oh, we'll write 5 pages. And then we turned them to 13. You know, it's productive, but sometimes we have to wrangle ourselves, I think, as Noah was saying.
Awesome. Well, this was great. Thank you for doing this and sharing this. And you guys are really interesting to just get ideas from.
Yeah, thanks for having us on. This was awesome.
Very thought-provoking. Yeah, we appreciate it.